back to good Father Capon and good Father Jansen and bad Father Jacobs and all their many wives and friends. Let me just recap a bit. I think I'm seeing one or two faces that I didn't see yesterday. There's one. The book is Exit 36, written by an Episcopal priest, Father Robert Capon. The book is, oddly enough, a novel about an Episcopal priest named Father William Jansen, Bill, whose alter ego is known as Arthur. That's when he talks to himself, he's talking to Arthur. Got the names up here, Father Jansen and his wife Liz. The other three main characters in the story are Father Ted Jacobs, who is dead as the story begins, having died by his own hand. His wife is Anne, and she receives the pastoral care of Father Jansen in her grief and bereavement. Also receiving pastoral care from Father Jansen is Father Jacob's mistress of recent years, a lady named Pat Donahue. So that's the story. It's a story about pastoral care, so it's a story about all the great things in life, you know, love and sin and death and all that stuff. And what makes the eschatology, the study, the doctrines of the last things, painless, or as close to painless as you can get, is the gospel context in which it's presented. Just to get you into that gospel again a little bit, let me read, if I can find where it is, that section about the marriage feast. I said at the outset yesterday that this, I'm going to have to watch my notes or they'll be the next thing sacrificed. I see this whole book as an exposition on that passage in 2 Corinthians. God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself, not imputing their trespasses unto them, and hath committed unto us the ministry of reconciliation. Reconciliation is the picture of gospel that Capon uses most fully in his book. That's why I got in my plug during your lecture. Did you catch me at it? And the strongest gospel I see comes in the story of the wedding feast. That's found in Matthew chapter 22. And let me read it to you according to Capon. The king who threw the wedding party for his son. First he invited all his classy friends, all the old money with the right connections and the right manners and the chauffeur-driven Bentleys and the Givenchy gowns. The beautiful people who can really make a gorgeous gala evening, a reconciled perfect party. Well, they all give him chintzy excuses and beg off. The king has one tremendous fit, writes them off as a bunch of deadbeats and decides to make a reconciled party on his own. He sends out his servants and tells them to drag in anybody they can find. So the servants go down to the Bowery, and there they round up a bunch of numbers runners, old whores, and drunks asleep in the doorway with wine bottles in brown paper bags. They even get the grifter down on Christie Street who waits till your car is stopped for a light and then hits you for a dime not to wipe your windshield with a greasy rag. And then they bring this deluxe assortment of bums, tarts, and winos to the palace, and the king goes to work on them. He phones up the wardrobe mistress at the Royal Opera Company and has her send over all the costumes she can spare. Then he gives everybody a free costume at the door and tells them to go wash up and change any costume they like, anyone at all. Well, the party starts and it looks gorgeous. The champagne flows and the hors d'oeuvres never stop coming, and pretty soon some of the gorgeousness begins to rub off on the guests themselves. That's an interesting idea, I think. An interesting addition to the original parable, that the gorgeousness of the party begins to infiltrate the guests. The drinks are free, so they stop cadging and swiping bags from each other. They catch glimpses of themselves in the mirror, and they're so surprised at how good they look, they actually start acting better. They use manners they thought they'd forgotten years ago. And everything goes fine until the king sees this one sourpuss standing next to the door with his costume in a heap at his feet. And he goes over to him and he says, "What's wrong? Doesn't it fit? Don't you like it? Take another." But he's grumpy and he won't answer. That, by the way, fits the text in Matthew, which says he was silent when the king approaches him. And the king tries again and says, "Come on, put it on, join the party." But he still won't talk. And then the king gets really mad and he says, "Look, Buster, this is my party and I'm not going to have you louse it up for no reason. If you don't like it, you can leave." But the grouch won't leave either. So the king calls the royal bouncer and he says, "Marty, you see this punk here? Convince him he can go to hell if he doesn't like my party. And convince him right now." You see, the point is, there is nothing you need to do to get in. You only have to accept the reconciliation which has already been made for you. And above all, there is nothing you can do to keep from getting in. Those servants the king sent out, they all carried pistols. The only way you can get out of the party is to refuse the reconciliation, to think that your own moral preoccupations or whatever are more important than putting on the free costume and joining the fun. That's Father Jansen's capsuling of it after he's told the parable to Anne, I believe, at this point, the widow of the suicided priest. "Nobody has to do any bookkeeping," says Jansen. "Ted is reconciled." Ted is the priest who died. "He's reconciled already, and so are you, and so am I. And all we have to do is throw the ledgers in the trash can and get on with the party." Anne objects, and she says, "That doesn't sound particularly moral," which is exactly the objection, I think, of the elder brother. "That's not moral. It's not right. It's not fair." And Father Jansen says, "Exactly. Most of the parables are made deliberately immoral. The elder brother gets gypped. The people who worked all day aren't paid any more than the ones who worked only an hour. And that's no way to run a union." Just to make the point that it's the mystery of reconciliation that's the main thing and not moral bookkeeping. Okay, that's I think, the most beautiful and explicit kind of gospel that goes on in this book. It goes on elsewhere, but that's the longest section and the one with the biggest punch as I read it. That's the packing now around which the eschatology, which that's the packing that fits around the eschatology that's being delivered here. We talked yesterday a bit about death as offering, not as robbery, death not as an accident or as an afterthought on the part of God, but death always something. You don't want to be sacrificed either.
Think about it a little bit first.
Beautiful. Here I am talking about death as offering and he's moving back.
You have to convince me.
Capon makes the point that death for a great many humans is robbery. It is something that is swiped from us, that was ours and is ours no longer, life that is, and those are, that's the way we conceptualize it, that's the way we feel about it. And he's suggesting instead that death be viewed as offering and the death of Christ be seen as the model, not the death of Adam. Adam's death was robbery to him. It could have been offering for Adam, but Adam was a failed priest. He refused to offer. This fits a kind of pious thought that is a bit foreign to many Lutherans, I think. If you talk to your Catholic friends and they're having trouble, grief, misery, sickness, fear, whatever, and they are of a particular Roman Catholic stripe, they will say, you will say, well, how do you relate that to God? And they will say, I offer it up. Ever heard that? You've been puzzled at it? That's what Capon's talking about, the offered life. You, as priest, who offers to God that which God has already given you, offer it all. You offer up not just, you know, your great joys and not just your praise, but you offer up everything.
Sir, I have a Catholic friend who refuses to take Novocaine when she very well could use it at the dentist because Christ suffered for her, therefore she is willing to offer this experience to God.
It's an interesting thing. I don't think I'd do it.
No.
I'd wonder about her a bit. I think you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. But it's a penance kind of thing, I think. You know?
All right. I guess my problem with that is not a Christian one. My problem with that is an American one. I'm interested in avoiding pain if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because I'm an American. And that's where that's coming from. But when you sit without the pain or the immediate prospect of pain and consider it, it's really not a crazy thing to do, is it, that she's doing? She is experiencing something and she's linking that with her faith and it has that kind of meaning for her. How about people who pray on their knees on hard boards? Huh? We good Americans put a cushion down, don't we? Or we do it in a chair or lying in bed. Is there any advantage to praying on your knees every day on hard boards? You get knobby knees. It's going to make you look funny in a sauna. But might there be something to that? Or another pious practice that Americans really have a hard time getting with is fasting. As religious practice, it just, you know, runs across the grain for them. Another little section on death in here that I said yesterday I would share with you has to do with Father Jansen's recital of the time when his twins died. In my whole life, I have been to honest, death-facing funeral rites under only two circumstances. Between our fourth and fifth child, we had twins, Grace and Paul. Grace was stillborn, strangled by the umbilical cord. I asked the friars at Little Portion, that was a monastery nearby, if I could have a small plot in their cemetery and told the undertaker I would take care of things myself. A brother priest came over. We said a mass of the angels and then went and dug the grave ourselves. Paul, the other twin, had a congenital heart defect and died 24 hours later. Same arrangements. Except this time, my two sons, 7 and 5, undertook with me. We talked while we worked in the August heat. Make the bottom level. How long will it take for the box to rot? Is the dirt piled high enough? These are questions from little kids, you can tell, because adults wouldn't ask those questions, would they? We're too silenced by death to ask them. Is the dirt piled high enough to end up level after it collapses? There. Is that smooth enough? We mopped our foreheads, read the rite for the burial of a child, and tramped back to the friary barn with the farm shovels over our shoulders. Do you know how I felt? Human. I like that. The other kind of funeral I put in the same class is the burial of a priest or a religious, according to the old custom. too bad Ted's wasn't done that way. I hope mine is. First of all, you are buried in mass vestments. One of your brother priests has to vest your corpse to make sure the job gets done right. I haven't had to do it yet, but unless I'm the first in my class called up, the job is waiting for me. Then, too, you're laid out in a chancel of the church, and a vigil is set up till the requiem. Priests and others take an hour or so apiece all through the night and day, so that there is no time when there isn't somebody there. Finally, your pallbearers are real friends, not paid flunkies. I think, you know, an insight into a very direct approach to death. Would it be fair to say, I think Capon is being highly autobiographical here. I don't have data for that. But how else could you know that? Who could write that who hadn't done it? I think he's talking about the death of his own two infants and their burial. Either that or he's listened to some folks who did it. Would it be fair to say that he sees death as offering? Or as somebody said yesterday, that he has arrived at stage one of accepting his own death. He accepts it. It's real. It's going to happen. And that's not something you need to do, you know, very hurriedly on a hospital bed someday. It's something you can do now. Or at least consider at this point. To accept one's own death as not robbery, but as offering. comments on the material on death, or on anything? Or have I silenced you with this kind of talk?
Let me just say that in the short ministry that I had among German missions in South Dakota, something very similar to that happened. A child was born with a congenital heart defect, and it was a blacksmith's child, and they were very poor. They made the wood box themselves. It was one of these congregations, everybody in town belonged to my parish, that when there was a funeral, everything stopped. They came to the church and got a little splotch from you, in the archive, and that's what it was. And they actually, no matter whether it was a tragic, or whether it was an old man, or whether it was a young person like this child, there was a real funeral. They expected everything to be done. Everyone, also for that child. I don't think really the whole town shut down for that child, but there was a good-sized congregation there. And I thought that was very human, too. Extremely good for everyone. And that's the way the community helped itself. I think we've come so far away from all that stuff. One of the worst things that bothered me at first is when they would shovel in the dirt on top of it. And then you really hear that. It is the dust and dust ash. And that's not kept from anybody.
Yeah.
And then they finally go back and eat together, and then life starts off again. Otherwise, they don't eat together from the time that the death ends. At least that was the custom at that time. Now, these are mostly European, maybe even Russian customs. But I think we have lost so much just because of the place. It's funky.
Yeah.
Just because of that.
I recall an experience I had in my ministry. The people I didn't know very well, an old man had died, and I was asked to perform the funeral, and did so. And, the standard way of doing a committal in our part of the country is, they lay out the fake grass, and they got the device there for lowering the casket, and the casket is placed on that. And people gather around who are coming, and you have the committal service, and then everybody leaves, and you walk away. You turn your back on and walk away from this casket, which is standing there still above ground. And I guess that always clashed a little for me. In St. Louis, the funeral folks want to hand you three flowers when you say earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And you place three flowers very carefully on the nice brocade, okay? And I wouldn't stand for that. I said, I'll use dirt, and I'll handle it with my hands. so you use some actual earth at that point. But still, we were all walking away with the casket still up there. This particular funeral, And this got to me because I'd never seen it before. The widow. Everybody else took off, and the widow sat there on her chair. And people were coming and saying, get her out of here, you know. We want to get to work. And so I spoke with her. I didn't know what she was thinking. And she said, I want to see him buried. Evidently, that was coming out of some custom she had been familiar with. And so she and I sat there, the big limo back at the road with the engine idling, waiting for us. And now that's really a different experience. It's not a bunch of guys with shovels like was your experience. It's a backhoe. Plunk, thump, thump, thump all over the bottom of the casket, you know. First the lowering of the casket, then they take the thing away, and then the backhoe comes in, you know, a little Ford tractor. Puts down its 2 feet and starts breaking the dirt in. And then they haul in a compressor, and they have a tamping device run by compressed air. And so they put in a foot or two of earth, and these guys jump down in there, they start the compressor, you know what kind of noise that makes. And then here are these guys down there going, making the dirt solid. I think you have to do that in St. Louis because it's all clay, and you know, it's not topsoil, it's going to filter together nicely. It's big lumps. And that lady sat there and watched that whole thing until the whole business was up and the dirt was all back in the hole, and as is the custom, the flowers were laid over the top. I'd never seen that before.
Just one other comment here, go too long, but in one case, a man burned to death and his old father came to me just before they were going to do this, and he said to me, Herr Pastor, the undertaker has it wrong. My son is not chasing the east. How will he see our Lord in resurrection?
Whee!
That
had to turn it off. This is very interesting. Yeah. You can tell, I've walked through villages in India, and they will say, those graves are for my grandparents. They were not yet Christians. And those are the graves of my parents. They were Christians. And it just didn't hit me. And they said, well, you see, those are facing north and south. These are facing east and west. And it's a very strong idea of... among the Christians in India, that people rise to the east. The speed with which funerals are taken care of in India, and the whole undertaking process is done by the family. The body is washed and shaved, or if that's necessary, and adorned. And the cosmetic abilities over there with what they have are not very great. I suppose the things, I don't want to make this very brief because I go on for hours, but the one thing that I can still remember was a colleague of mine who died while I was in the hospital. I was okay. I survived, I think. And the funeral had to be conducted within the day, and I had just gotten out of the hospital. Dorothy drove to the funeral, and as I got there, they said, would you have the funeral sermon? Well, I had been in the hospital flat and was in no emotional state to take it, so another person was already prepared, but this was a particular courtesy that they had given to me. But as the funeral service was going on, the body was lying in the casket, and because it had lasted a little more than a day, the decomposition had started, and juices, I hope this didn't turn you off too much, but the juices were beginning to trickle out of the mouth. And the person who was taking care of that was his niece. He was a bachelor, but he had a niece and a nephew who were particularly dear to him. And here that niece was sitting next to the body, and as this would trickle out, she'd take a handkerchief and wipe it away. She was the one who would do that. You know, I'd say, golly, not me. But that was her feeling. This is my relationship to my uncle as I bid farewell to him.
Kind of a last service.
A last service. And then, of course, the whole business of putting this into the coffin into the grave. And no flowers. Clunks of earth. And they went bunk on a deal wood box.
One of the more moving scenes in movies that I can recall of this sort was you remember the movie Exodus, and the scene after the young girl has been killed, and they're all standing there, and they have lowered her coffin in, and then each person in the community, in the kibbutz, grabs a shovel full of earth, and they all file past, and the shovel is there, and you take your shovel full and put it in the hole. Each person assisting in that burial, I think, would be a very powerful thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Working in a hospital last summer, working with the chaplain's department, I learned of their practice and actually participated in it with emergency room deaths, which was that it made no difference how maimed the body was, but family members had the opportunity and were very strongly encouraged to go into the room with the deceased and to spend some time and to touch and in some way grasp the reality of the departure and to say goodbye before the undertakers get a hold, before the cosmetic reconstruction is done, before the undertakers, you know, have a whole wardrobe of suits. A lot of people die and they don't have a suit, and so you simply say, well, this would be a nice one. Very artificial kind of thing, see, before all of that. I also learned about a practice which I guess is still prevalent in Sweden. I don't know how prevalent yet. At least in rural Sweden, when somebody dies, the coffin has usually been made in the home and is ready, and the person is put in the coffin and then usually set in one of the outbuildings. Fine. Then everybody who is his friend, you see, will come by and call on him and sort of settle accounts. And as I understand it, there's a kind of conversation that goes on between you know, people who were not reconciled with each other, one now deceased. But usually over a glass of snaps or something like that, you see. And only after everyone has had the opportunity to do that.
Alone.
Yeah, you see. And then come into the farmhouse, usually after this, and for coffee and or something. But only then does the funeral take place. So in this sort of modern American hospital practice and Swedish practice, I see that we're recognizing the need somehow to accept our own finitude, and in a hands-on kind of way. I think it's very important.
One last thing about that, and this is not coming from the book at all, but coming from my own experience with people who have been bereaved, and that's almost everybody sooner or later. What I find is we all look at death with some particular hang-ups. I think our culture hangs us up about death. I think there are things that happen before we can cognize very well and handle it that create strong impressions. And then the way in which our culture sidesteps the whole matter of finitude and death and bereavement and loss, I find it, however, to be highly workable. You know, people have images in their minds about that determine for them the meaning of death, and it's usually horrible. Death as loss of control. I worked for a while with a young man who. What was really tearing him apart was the fact that he would be helpless when he was dead. And he was afraid of being helpless. And that would be the final helplessness. And his image, and this is really, will strike you no doubt as peculiar, but the image that bothered him was the thought of lying in his coffin and seeing people going by and not being able to greet them. Not being able to reach out and touch them, seeing them sad at his death, and not being able to offer them any solace at all himself. Other images of unreality that are often associated with death. You know, death is something I don't know how to deal with. And where that often comes from is the small children who are exposed to death in a society of adults who refuse to talk about it and refuse to be straight about it, because the culture doesn't set us up to be straight about it. Culture sets us up to deny. Imagine the small child at the funeral of dear old uncle. Well, he knows he saw his mother weeping this morning in the kitchen. He knows she's not happy. He goes to the funeral home for the funeral, and the funeral home, first off, is a strange place. You know, everybody smiles and is polite, and is uptight as all get out, because we have this great thing about controlling emotion in a funeral. You know, you're not supposed to break down, right? And so everybody's tense. Kid can perceive the tension, but he can't understand it because nobody's telling him about it. And then the clash between what is said and what he perceives emotionally in the people around him. He perceives sadness, and what is said is, well, isn't it a good thing? He's not suffering anymore. He's with Jesus now, and the clergy come and further compound it by saying, you know, it's glorious, let's sing resurrection hymns and be really happy. And he knows nobody's happy. And so the kid is getting, you know, this very irreconcilable sort of double message. And what that computes to him as is unreality. You know, I can't get a hold of this. And that sticks. And here you got somebody now who's well equipped to join the American throng and sidestep death for his entire life until he finally gets on his own deathbed and there has to take that, finally, that step one, yes, I am indeed going to die. How much better, I think, Capon's way, to see death not as accident, but as part of life, part of the Creator's design, something that is going to happen to us all, just like a whole lot of other things. And with all those other things, death also is something we can offer up. On to judgment. Ready for judgment? The attitudes here, I think, are Pauline. Sting of death is sin. Strength of sin is the law. And what the law does is constantly accuse us. Capon's point is, because the king has planned the wedding feast, because the wedding garment is being offered to each of us, and because the party has already begun, judgment is something we do to ourselves. It's not something God does. We feel guilty and mess around with blame. And I want to read you a little section here of Father Jansen's words to Anne. Anne was working on blaming herself. This is the bereaved wife, working on blaming herself for her husband's death, which is a very common sort of reaction in the bereaved, to feel guilty. Father Jansen says, messing around with blame is like sipping poison. The real point is that God isn't blaming anyone. All the blame has been soaked up into the death of Christ, out of the world into the giant eternal blotter. That's in caps. Get it? We are all forgiven everything. You, me, Ted, everybody. That's the good news. The only bad news is our insisting that somehow we're not. I don't know why it is so hard for us to get that straight, but it is. The church has an absolutely rotten record of getting itself to take the big promise of Christ seriously. Then a little aside, now this is a dialogue within himself, to Arthur. Good Lord, Arthur, is that ever true? All those centuries of sin sheets, all that endless fuss and confession about exactly how blameworthy this act or that thought is. Quote, especially I accuse myself of the following sins, boasting three times and maybe once talking about myself when I didn't have to, and masturbating twice, but only alone, not with others. Oh, sure, there were warnings about the dangers of scrupulosity. Scrupulosity is the over-conscientiousness. But they were really just salve the church spread on her own conscience for all the damage she did by tarring everybody with the blame brush. The majority of the race, of course, were tough enough bastards not to take it too seriously, but the poor, sensitive soul, who were already half bonkers anyway, took it all in and really got freaked out. Either way, however, it turned what should have been a celebration of forgiveness into an orgy of guilt and stood the gospel right smack on its head. A little farther on then, direct words to Anne, lean back in the everlasting arms. You're being hugged and kissed to death by the greatest lover of all. He's got it all together. Nothing you've ever done or will do amounts to a hill of beans compared to the holy mountain of reconciliation. Then regarding her husband, Ted, and his the bind that he was in, and now his judgment on himself, but more about judgment. Did Ted decide to drop Pat, the lover, and then find that he couldn't? Or did he decide to leave Anne, his wife, and realize he couldn't do that either? And then what? Did he decide that because he couldn't live with two sets of books, he had to kill the bookkeeper? Which is what he did. If so, who did he think told him two sets of books was a sin against the Holy Ghost? Not God, Arthur. Some mother of a church, maybe. Or some other mother, but not God. Peter kept two sets of books, and Paul too, probably. Paul only gets a probably on that. And Judas for sure. The difference was that Peter and Paul managed somehow to remember that God doesn't give a damn whether you or I can pass an audit. He's already blotted out the handwriting that was against us. Judas forgot that. He had it all together himself. And in the effort, all he did was knock himself apart. We've all got one shining purpose and two sets of books. And most of us, one way or another, get tripped up by it because this is a bitchy, unforgiving world. But if God says it doesn't matter, if he takes in prodigals and pays everybody equal at the end, where in hell do we get off deciding that there are some performances he's got to hold against us? The sheer point-missing genius of it all, the surpassing ability to hit the bullseye on the wrong target, the offer of free grace duly received and then expounded as meaning that there's nothing good you can do to earn your way in instead of that there's nothing bad you can do to keep you out. He tries one corner of this on Anne. The trouble is that when most of us start thinking, we imagine we are under some solemn necessity to come up with answers that will make us more acceptable to God. God only knows what was bothering Ted, but it doesn't matter. The real point is that God has said once for all on the cross that whatever it was, it isn't bothering God. Even if we can't get it all together, he can, and he will, and he has, and he does. So there's judgment. Judgment is something we do to ourselves. Some advice then on how to handle guilt. The advice is to forgive yourself. I'll read you a short section there. This is to Anne again. Forgive yourself. God already has. So don't spend even 10 seconds disagreeing with him. Put on the wedding garment and join the party. Judgment is something we do to ourselves. Because, you see, you forgive yourself because that puts you in tune with God. If we remember, the big point being made in this whole book is that God is reconciling. Above all else, God is reconciling. Then, on quickly to heaven and hell. Remembering what we said about time and eternity, and I think this is pretty important stuff for getting a hold of how Capon's going to deal with the whole Christian corpus of doctrine. To get a hold of the time eternity, to get a hold of let that analogy that I gave you yesterday from the Divine Fox stick. When we humans talk about God, it's like a rock and a clam and a starfish talking about a ballerina. It's going to be analogical speech is all we can do. We can't talk directly about God. That's the kind of word game that theology is. We can use simile and metaphor and analog, and that's all. And if we try to you know, nail any one of those down, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It ain't going to work. So, and then this insight about time and eternity as being, eternity is something you, that's an attribute of God. It is not an attribute of us, except as we are in Him. Time is our way of thinking about things. We think linearly, you know, now, before, later. God is not bound by that as we are bound by that. Time is for us, but because we are His, we can participate in His eternity, which is not an endless procession of days, but an eternal now. Maybe something that will help you get a hold of it a little better. He muses about sexuality in heaven. Are you ready for that? In heaven, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Scripture. But watch how you interpret that. Be very slow to solve the problem by thinking that the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem as having got bravely past the recent sexual pleasantness. That's an impossible notion by anybody's imagery. Whatever the resurrection of the body is about, it's about bodies. Even when it was figured as taking place in the hereafter, it always meant getting back all of your members. And if you figure it as I'm trying to, eternal life as this present life held, reconciled now in Christ, then you are not only, then you not only have an everlasting member, but some everlasting action too. Everybody get that? What he's saying is, if we're really serious about resurrection of the body, sexuality is something that's going to continue. It's not something that gets put away. A little more. In the opening out of the web, the unfolding of the mystery of God, of course, in the eternal performance of the piece, we are now only sight reading for the first time. In the endless exploration of the mystery, we are now given only the most cursory of casings. We will no doubt be surprised to find out how much more there was to it than we ever suspected. I think that that's a worthy thought about everything in human life, not just sexuality, but here he's applying it to sexuality. But we've been down that road before. Even here in this life, we do eventually discover that there is more to sex than jerking off. Maybe in Christ there's more to it than making love. More to it than falling deliriously into romance. More to it than lying comfortably in an old marriage bed on a hazy day off. Okay? Admittedly, it's hard to figure how, since all we've got are the present images. But for my money, it just mustn't be figured as a suspension of anything. A removal of restrictions, perhaps, of the exclusivity of marriage or of the irrationality of romance, or an opening up of possibilities of ascent through fun in bed to the processions of the Trinity, of which fun in bed has so far been the merest sketch. Anything, just don't turn the Creator into a castrator. Add on, don't cut back. Everybody into the wedding garments for the main event, the grand aeonic ascent into whatever the hell it was that fidelity was all about. Okay, are you with it? Up, up and away from the earthbound notion that its depths can be plumbed by not using your plumbing in a motel in Dubuque, into the clear air of perpetual, faithful openness to everyone. This is a really interesting idea to me. What he's saying is the marital relationship, where fidelity is desperately important, okay, as we experience it here, might prove to be a model for all kinds of faithfulness of a more expanded kind that we could experience in heaven. Never thought of that before. But on into the blinding light of the perfect oneness of the Word and the Spirit and the Father. That maybe that's, you know, that's his clue. That maybe that's what marital fidelity is all about. It's an experience. I've said that. I said that here last year. And remember that the what propels us and what forms the foundation for the marital relationship is the desire for unity with another person. We have all kinds of unities. Marriage, I think, is the model, the prime example. There, and that's what people are getting into when they get married. They're getting into the experience of building a permanent, exclusive kind of intimate relationship with another human being. And that's something we want, because that's the way God made us. And what he's suggesting is, I think, the same thought, that that continues, that desire for unity. And it's not unity of a fusion kind. It's a unity of two. It's building a unity between two separate critters. So there still are two, but they are united. That's the marriage model. And maybe that's what heaven's all about. Maybe that's what fidelity's all about. That's about as much as I have to say about his notions about heaven and hell. Hell is there. Hell is the guy who stands there and refuses to put on the wedding garment, who refuses the reconciliation. Another thought that ties closely with Myron's thought this morning about in the parable of the prodigal son, as the story ends, as told by Jesus, you know, the elder brother is kind of hanging out there. He has not been reconciled. Younger brother has. Older brother has not been reconciled either to father or to brother. And I would add, either to God. And the necessity of fitting together reconciliation to God and to brother is there. It's implicit in that story, isn't it? The one goes with the other. And part of Kirpan's thought is that, okay, the wedding garment's out there. It's held up for you. You know, pick one, put it on, join the party. That's to be reconciled to God. Join the party is to be reconciled to each other as well, because that's the only kind of party it can be. And that means for the elder brother, to use him as an example, he's got to get over being pissed off. He's got to understand everything differently from the way he understands it now. His relationship to the father, his relationship to his brother. That's the nature of reconciliation for him. That's the nature of reconciliation for all of us. Therefore, all that stuff in the New Testament about forgiving each other, performing the reconciliation on a human level. He, in the book, he does something that I think not many pastors, myself included, would have the nerve to do. Anne, the wife, learns about the love affair. She had suspected it, but had been, you know, looking the other way, hoping it would go away or wasn't true. She had suspected it, but she learns of it, kind of point blank, and learns who the other woman was, learns of Pat. And Father Jansen, in his work with Anne, in his pastoral care of her, encourages her to get to know Pat, because each of them was loving part of one man. Encourages her to be reconciled with Pat. To maybe, you know, I can't imagine what that scene would look like. Well, yes, I can, and it scares me. These two women kind of, you know, glaring at each other. the injured wife and the other woman now needing to put together, needing to be reconciled with each other in order to participate fully in the reconciliation by affecting it in their own lives with each other. It's not whether or not they're saved, it's not whether or not they put on the wedding garment, okay, but it's whether or not they can participate fully in reconciliation by being reconciled to each other.
But for that thing to work, I mean, you're going to have a pretty radical kind of abandonment of some sort of notions of justice and rights and hurt and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, putting it on the level of pastoral care responsibility, I'm just not sure that any pastor can change the world.
How many folks can handle that?
Enough to see this happening. I mean, it seems to me that there'd be a pretty potentially devastating kind of thing to do to Anne and probably to both of them. Because what the pastor would be doing, what the pastor would be doing, would be laying on another kind of obligation.
That's the tricky part of the pastoral care scene there, I think, that you are not making her reconciliation to God contingent on her ability to be reconciled to this other woman. And I think there we have to be very realistic about human strength and weakness and ability. I worked with a marriage situation a couple of years ago where young people, you know, married all 4 or 5 years was all, and an affair had gone on with the husband and a younger woman, and the wife then reporting to me kind of her relief, her feeling of relief when she had a conversation finally with the other woman. She had seen her at a party or something, but you know, it was across the room. She kind of knew who she was before she knew that she was her husband's lover. So she knew, had a general idea of what the woman looked like physically, but had no one-to-one contact. And then one day, in a somewhat desperate search for her husband, had used the phone number that he had given her of a place where he might be, and she knew what it meant. It was the girlfriend's apartment, and she needed to get in touch with her husband and called, and the other woman answered, and she exploded and wept, and the response of the other woman was very moderate and understanding. You know, saying things like, I'm amazed that you can talk to me. You must hate me. And out of that situation, which most of us can barely even think about, you know, I think came some rapport between these two women. The wife was finding herself relieved, no longer needing to hate her. And this is without any work on my part.
A face-saving mechanism, I mean, you know, a kind of denial of certain realities, because otherwise you couldn't just bear the anguish and the hurt and the sense of being cheated and robbed and a promise that was supposed to last forever, you know, it all has been violated, and now you have to kind of pretend that you're modern and it's okay.
No, that was not it. That was not what was going on, no. No, there was no exaggerated cool here.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was rage. And all the kind of pain that would go with this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I present this not as, you know, just as proof that I've seen it one time. It can happen. To lay that on the pastor for his pastoral care would be to lay a lot, I agree.
Yeah, sure.
And you would want to use
too much on the people.
Great discrimination in doing that. But to make the point, I think he does it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
To make the point. Well, bells are ringing. Time to quit. Thank you.